Blog Talk Radio.
Today on Backroom Politics, pregame analysis on the President's State of the Union speech. Can the President hit one out of the park to upgrade a 38% approval rating? What are the possible highlights of the speech? And pig pile on Mitt. Newt comes back to win in a big way in South Carolina. Pig pile on Newt. Romney and the field come out aggressively against Newt in Florida. How is this going to play out in the GOP ticket? This and Tell Me a Story today on Backroom Politics. And we're live here in Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio, as we are every Tuesday. Joining me, as they do every week, to my left, he is the former 8th-term member of Congress representing Washington State's 2nd Congressional District, and the former Vice President of Government Affairs for Burlington Northern Railroad. He is Congressman Al Swift. Congressman, welcome
How
back.
How do you feel on this lovely day?
It is a lovely day. It's actually kind of nice. It was better than yesterday. The ice, snow, yeah. All that crap. And joining me to my 11 o'clock, as he does every week, he is the former Undersecretary of Commerce. He is a longtime serving staffer in the U.S. Senate, and he has served, what's the count now, 4 presidents? That hasn't changed since last week, has it, Alan? The Honorable Alan Moore. Alan, how you doing?
Hey, I'm doing
fine. Good
to be here.
To my 12 o'clock, he is the former floor chief for Congressman Gerald R. Ford. He is the former vice president of government affairs for the National Broadcasting Corporation. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob, how you doing, sir?
I'm glad to be here.
And to my right, he is the Vice President of China Affairs for the Eurasia Center. He is a bar-certified attorney in the District of Columbia in the great city of New York. He is Dr. Ralph Whitty. Ralph, how you doing?
Great to be with everyone, and happy Chinese New Year.
Happy Chinese. Happy Year of the Dragon.
Water Dragon.
Water Dragon, right. Oh, wow.
Great success and prosperity for everyone to come.
God, from your mouth to God's ears, that means we might get more than like 5 listeners every once in a while. That'd be nice. No, that's kidding. We know there's hundreds and hundreds of you out there. Hey, there's a lot of stuff going on today here in Washington, and there's a lot of stuff going on down south. But the big news today in Washington, D.C., other than the fact that traffic's going to be a nightmare around Capitol Hill, it is the Tuesday of the State of the Union address for President Barack Obama. Some are calling this what could possibly be the most important speech of his presidency. This could be a speech that could either help him lock down a second term. It is a speech that he could come out with something new and innovative, or it could fall flat and give Republicans something to crow about. But the big question is, everybody's asking, how important is tonight's speech to President Obama? Al, I'm going to start with you on the Democratic side.
Well, I think it's very important. I do not expect him to fall on his face. He just doesn't on major speeches like this. I doubt seriously if there's anybody who can give a good enough speech that it would elect them president now. If this is really the start of his campaign, and he will win it or lose it down the line. But it's very important that he get off to a good start. So he needs a real bang-up speech tonight.
Bob, you agree with that?
Absolutely. I think he probably will have a pretty good speech. The president he rises to the occasion usually in situations like this, and I expect he'll do a good job tonight.
But, Alan, you know, with everybody putting the spotlight, taking the spotlight away from the GOP ticket and putting it back on Barack Obama, I mean, this is one bully pulpit he cannot come out of. He's literally got to have one out of the park, or can he survive with just being marginally successful?
I don't remember a State of the Union that was knocked out of the park. It's too much stuff that you have to cover. I mean, the best presidential speeches in terms of emotion are ones around a particular item, usually an international crisis.
George Bush, 2001.
Absolutely. Or this president, who just this week had an extraordinary moment that I don't expect to be repeated tonight, but with a group of donors up in New York. He sang a little Al Green song.
Which, by the way, he was on.
The crowd loved it, and his grin and smile was infectious. And he looked over to the side and said, they didn't think I would do this. I'd love to see a little of that tonight. I don't expect it. He's got to cover the waterfront. He's got to be overseas. He's got to be domestic. He's got to be political. It's a massive mishmash of stuff. He'll do a decent job. He may do a little overreaching, and I've read that there's two people who are going to be sitting up with his wife. One is Warren Buffett's secretary, who is almost certainly a multimillionaire because she owns stock that doesn't pay dividends, but she has relatively low income even as she's getting wealthy. I'm not sure she's the one you want to be your poster child for arguing about taxes. And then the other person up there is going to be the widow of Steve Jobs, Mrs. Steve Jobs. Now, Steve Jobs was a genius, and oh my God, what an impact he's made on the world, and what an impact he's made on overseas jobs. Most of the work of Apple Computer is done in China. And if it's not done in China, it's done in other Asian countries,
right.
Taiwan and Korea, and it's really quite interesting. So it's a little risky. You put those people up, you call attention to them, you get a little standing ovation for them, and then it prompts the press to start looking back and say, who are these people?
I want to touch on that, but Ralph, go ahead.
Yeah, I think it would show great leadership on President Obama's part. He said in the State of the Union that he was wrong to put Simpson-Bowles on the back burner, and now he's going to take it off the shelf and implement it. I think that would be bold leadership.
Now, that would be bold. I want to go back to something that Alan was talking about. The two people are going to be up in the gallery this evening sitting next to Mrs. Obama. Let's talk about the secretary for Warren Buffett. I mean, I don't expect her to be flying commercial aircraft into Reagan since she was giving press earlier in Omaha. But that being said, Bob, you know, when the president talks about the quote-unquote Buffett rule, is the secretary of the nation's richest human being, is that the right approach, kind of going off of what Alan was saying?
Well, I think Alan, you know, sort of hits it on the head. I mean, here's a woman who may not have $1 million salary, but she's got more than $1 million in stock options. It probably didn't cost her a penny, and she's doing just fine, thank you.
But that's an inside the Beltway
sure.
observation.
Yeah.
Guys
but
inside
what is
the Beltway
it?
Don't know that.
Well, wait a minute. I want to go back to that, Al. I mean, is that an inside the Beltway observation? Or, you know, there's plenty of administrative assistants in Omaha, Nebraska that are probably making the same $35,000, $40,000, $50,000 wages that she's making, but doesn't have the huge stock options in Berkshire Hathaway that she does. Is that the right message that the president's sending?
I'm just saying I don't think that the message will get received. Washington, D.C. is a town in which people are constantly sending messages and no one ever gets them.
Bob,
I don't think the message will be received tonight, but I would expect that there will be a number of comments in the media over the next week about just this point.
Alan.
Look, Obama has gotten a lot of mileage on the so-called Warren Buffett rule. Warren Buffett's a famous guy. Everybody knows who Warren Buffett is. People don't quite understand what it is exactly that his secretary pays more taxes and so on. And they can talk about taxes if you add in Social Security and Medicare and whatever her rate ends up being and whatever her salary is. And I bet it's more than $35,000 or $40,000. But the question here is, she's probably really wealthy. Now, I don't know if she is, but I have a feeling that if they're going to use her, the press is going to be all over that, like ticks on a cat. And they're going to say, what's going on here? Is she really, you know, struggling along? Oh, my gosh, she's got, you know, X millions of dollars worth of Berkshire Hathaway stock. How is she, by in any way, a good example? That's just a hunch. I don't know. We'll see.
Ralph.
As someone that has an LLM in tax from Georgetown, you work a lot with these top corporate CEOs, and they know the system. They know which law firms to employ to put together these complicated tax shelters to be able to shield their income. Someone like Buffett's secretary doesn't even comprehend that that is possible. And that is the whole issue in this country. Is people, the average person doesn't understand that there are ways to really lower your effective tax burden.
I think that the press would have to work awfully hard to make that any more important than a soggy donut. I just don't think...
You don't think that Fox News will jump on that?
It's not the... Fox News may jump on it, and the Republicans may jump on it. I think they were foolish to do so. I think it is it's just a very tiny, teeny little soft issue, and it takes longer to explain it so that Joe Blow will understand it than it does here in D.C., where you say it and everybody understands.
Alan.
Al, I would agree with you in the normal case. I don't think this issue has just taken on a big high visibility aura. But if she's up there and the president points her out in the middle of this televised nationwide speech, Warren Buffett's secretary, who pays higher rate of taxes than Warren Buffett, how is that fair? It's calling attention to her in ways that I don't think are going to be helpful to either her or the president. That's my hunch. Well, she's operating below the radar right now, no question. Nobody knows who she is. The moment she's pointed out on national TV sitting up there, suddenly she's fair game. And then we're going to know a lot more about her and whether this is a legitimate point he's making or not. That's my thought.
And it's going to be interesting to see what Obama comes out with in this speech about lowering taxes and trying to simplify the tax code. It's going to be very interesting to see how people react.
I've said what I've said, and you've said what you've said, and I don't think there's anything else to be said until such time as one of us gets to say, I told you so.
I know. Except we can say it again, Al. Yeah.
Maybe louder this time.
And it'll certainly be next week.
it does raise the question into the strategy of President Obama in tonight's speech. I mean, let's be honest. The economy is going to be the number one issue. The jobs issue, I mean, we're down around 8.9, 8.8. All of us around the table think that that's a kind of a magic number. We'll see that bump up here in the next couple of months after the seasonal jobs reports come out. But the reality is jobs and the economy are the big item. If you're going to sit there and you're going to point out somebody that has a $50,000 living wage that's paying the same taxes as Warren Buffett, but she's also got millions of dollars in options in Berkshire Hathaway, I think that it's simple. If somebody in middle America says she works for Warren Buffett, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to ask the question, does she have options in Berkshire Hathaway? And I think that's a legitimate question, quite frankly.
I remain to be convinced.
Wow. Let's talk about Steve Jobs now, the other person sitting in the gallery. We're kind of focusing on the gallery because traditionally those sitting next to the First Lady have been focal points or basis of going forward on a State of the Union address. Looking at Mrs. Steve Jobs, again, Alan, going back to your point, does that necessarily say, I mean, this is a very, very wealthy woman. And Apple does employ a good base in the Silicon Valley and in the San Francisco Bay Area, but to your point, it does state that a lot of the iPhones and iPads and MacBooks are made in China and Taiwan.
No, not a lot of them. All of them. once upon a time, Apple proudly wore this label of Made in America. They made all their computers, all the early Macs were made in America. And then over time, there's a fascinating big story in the New York Times this week that talks about the history of the evolution of this, that today America cannot do it. We do not have the manufacturing capacity. We don't have the skilled labor that can be increased by thousands of human beings literally overnight. It's quite interesting. I don't mind the fact that 200,000 Chinese in one massive complex make all the iPhones because assembling stuff really is relatively low-skilled work and wages make a huge difference. The thing that bothers me is many of the components, the outer shell, the glass, the
the computer memory chips inside, designed in America, but now manufactured in places with facilities that we cannot match. We cannot match them, and they would take hundreds of millions of dollars to repeat. That doesn't bother me from a basic standpoint of how the world works and how the economy works. And you know, I'd like to think companies put some measure of premium on employing people at home, and the folks at Apple have a lot of employees here. They do all this design work. They'd like to modify the immigration rules to let more skilled people in. But here again, the president is bringing her in. They're going to call attention to this. This business of using human props, by the way, started 30 years ago. It started after Air Florida crashed into the bridge, and a guy named Lenny Skutnik, who pulled the victim out of the water, jumped in, pulled her out. He was the first one, if I remember correctly, and Ronald Reagan had him up there with Mrs. Reagan, called attention to him, and suddenly it was like, wow, we can call attention to things, we can put human faces on some of these issues, get standing ovations, and it's been happening ever since. But it's not necessarily a free shot. You got to be careful. I'm a little concerned about these two, that they may not work out quite the way the president
Ralph.
Yeah, I think it's somewhat of a risky move for the Obama administration to have Mrs. Jobs there, simply because it brings the whole issue and focus of China into question. And China is a real hot-button issue right now, especially now that it's an election year and people don't have jobs in this country. We really have to look at an effective partnership with China in order to stimulate our economy. But now, I don't know if America is ready for this, something like that.
Well, this is all speculation, obviously. I mean, we don't know to what extent the president's going to put Mrs. Jobs or Warren Buffett's secretary into context, into the overall State of the Union address. But we've been around the block enough. This isn't our first radio. We can figure out what those points probably will be. But let's now go to what needs to happen tonight before we get into the details of what he could possibly say that would possibly blow the lid off. Let's look a little bit at what has to happen tonight. What does Obama have to do to convince the people that, A, this next year is going to be better than the first 3 years of his presidency, and two, can he solidify at least a good baseline for this to be a kickoff speech? Al?
Yes, he's got to do the baseline. I think there is absolutely no way that any speech given tonight is going to win the election in next November. What he's really doing is setting up his platform, or his diving board, if you will, the thing that's going to energize him into his campaign. You've got to remember that the Republicans have been drawing all of the attention. Not unfairly and not unreasonably, but it's been all Republicans. And he's been giving a few speeches, and he's been getting a little coverage on it. But when you're covering seven Republican candidates and the president, and you give them each an eighth of it, you don't know where that leads you. So he needs to have a good springboard, there's the word I'm looking forward, into his campaign.
So if that's the case, Bob, from a Republican viewpoint, what does he have to do to maybe convince some of the moderates or some of the independent voters that, hey, I'm your guy for the next 4 years?
Well, if I were advising the president, and I am not, I would say to him, the most important thing you can give the country tonight is some kind of a blueprint about what you're going to do about the unemployment. How are you going to encourage jobs? What are you going to do to get entrepreneurs to start spending some money? How are you going to get some of the folks with money to start investing it, taking it out of the banks and putting it into entrepreneurial efforts and putting it into jobs? Jobs is going to be the number one target everybody's going to be talking about.
And by jobs, we mean people being employed versus Mrs. Jobs, who's going to be sitting in the gallery.
Yes, we do indeed. And I think that, I mean, I would be absolutely flabbergasted if he doesn't do just that. If he doesn't do that, I think that what's going to be interesting is the Republicans, I suspect, in their response to the State of the Union, are going to have one word, a big sign: jobs, where are the jobs? And I suspect that the president will be smart enough to have an answer to that question, at least one that he can present as his program, and if he doesn't do that, I think he's making a big mistake, and I don't think he's going to make a mistake.
Ralph.
I think what Obama could do that would be very helpful is to assure small business owners that he would like to roll back a lot of costly regulations for small businesses. If you look at what Sam Graves said in Politico, small firms bear regulatory cost of $10,585 per employee, which is 36% higher than the cost of regulatory compliance for large businesses. And what small business owners have been telling the government is that the cost of regulatory compliance is the most important problem that they are facing. And that's hampering their ability to hire more employees.
So that begs the question, Alan, does the president come off with a reorganization? He's already reorganized part of the government, merging several agencies involved in international trade and other commercial aspects into Department of Commerce, your former agency.
It's a proposal.
Yeah. A proposal. Does he propose other streamlining of government to reduce regulatory stress?
You know, I think I don't see a lot there. That's a Republican line, and I don't see him sort of pivoting and trying to do that. My hunch is that he's going to say, last year I put out a plan, and it was rejected. Wasn't even given a true hearing or vote in the Congress. I'm going to be back with more of the same. I'll be willing to modify it. I'll be willing to work with them. But I can't do this alone, folks. And I need help from the Congress. I can't unilaterally pass laws. I'll do everything I can within my power, as I have already begun to do. But I need help from the Congress. I need help from all of you in this room. I hope you'll put aside your politics and join with me. I'm guessing he'll sort of make that pitch, even as he says to the public, this is me, this is what I'm trying to do, but I can't do it alone. I need help here.
Well, there's two questions in that point, but Al, I want to touch on one of them with you as a former member of Congress. When the president puts the ball into Congress's court, is that usually well received, saying, this is not my fault, it's you sitting out in the well today, this is your fault?
But that's exactly not what Alan just said. I think Alan, I've been sitting here thinking what he really should do is take a 2x4 and get down off the podium and bang a few heads on the Republican side. And that obviously would be counterproductive. The way to make that point is the way Alan so diplomatically put it, because the public knows that the Congress has been recalcitrant, and saying, I need your help if we're going to get anything done, is a positive way. It's better than my 2x4.
But does that sit well with the member of Congress? Saying, hey, this isn't my fault. This is literally your fault.
But that isn't what Alan said.
But the impression...
I would say, but it's not
but
what
does
Alan
that,
said.
That's what I'm asking. Is if he does
said,
come out
said
that
Alan's,
boldly...
Alan's way, it's awfully hard, I think, for the Republicans to criticize it. They can say, well, I assume that their response would be, well, we're certainly delighted to work with the president if he will... if he will make compromises on key areas where he's resisted our efforts to, they'll give a defense along those lines.
Bob!
Well, that's exactly right. You put together what Alan and Al just said, and that's the debate that's going to be the debate all year long. The president has some ideas. He wants to put them into practice. The Republican has some ideas. And both sides are going to be having to, trying to find a way to say, my way is better than your way. And there'll be some negotiations. Maybe they'll work, maybe they won't. But the whole year is going to be just this fight.
Well, if Obama exerts leadership and says, we're going to implement Simpson-Bolt, can he get the Republican Congress to come on board with that? What kind of reaction would he get?
That's just not an option. There was once upon a time a chance to bring that up for a single solitary vote. That passed. When you start breaking that thing up, you come back to these mega deals. That effort failed in December, and so on. So it is not an option that's available to him or anybody in the Congress.
And this is not the place to do it.
Yeah, this isn't the venue.
I think the 2x4s will come out later down on the campaign trail on both sides. But this, I don't think, is going to be nice.
But is the president, Al, is the president missing an opportunity, maybe, not so much a 2x4, but, you know, maybe like a big, heavy pillow, maybe.
Well, I think, you asked what Congress would resent. What Congress would resent, I think, would be a direct attack on their refusal, if he were to couch it this way, their refusal to cooperate in any organized fashion and letting their extremes nail their feet to the floor and all that kind of stuff. He's not going to do that. That would be resented.
All right, we're going to let that be the last word for this segment. When we come back, we're going to continue talking pregame on the President's State of the Union address tonight. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us. Radio. We're continuing our discussion on the pregame for tonight's State of the Union address, largely viewed as probably the most important speech in the president's career in the White House to date. We were talking a little bit more of the high-level stuff and some more of the strategy. Let's talk a little bit about some of the details that he might be able to come out with that are going to be of interest. Obviously, the economy is going to be a big play. Al, does the president have an opportunity to come out with something like, let's say, maybe a revision of the jobs bill? Is that a possibility?
Well, yes. Anything is a possibility. He has an opportunity to do all kinds of things. But I wouldn't predict that. I mean, I don't know what he's going to do. They've been working on it a long time. The thing I think you can say with some certainty is there will be some things that will be surprises or near surprises, and some things that will be a little more aggressive. But what worries me as a Democrat is that he's had an opportunity to do this all along. He has absorbed criticism and not really retaliated in an effective way. And this is an opportunity to do a little of that, and we'll see if he takes advantage of that opportunity.
Well, one of the things, Alan, that CNN was reporting is that they apparently got part of the speech leaked to them, and President Obama apparently is going to be talking about the quote-unquote fair shake and doing fair shake proposals. Some of the things he's talking about, tax reform, mortgage reform, higher taxes on upper earners, i.e. the Buffett rule, an expiration of Bush tax cuts. Can he sell that message to America and to Congress using the State of the Union to propose this, or is he coming out a little early?
I don't know that he can sell it, but it's not too early. He's going to have to talk about taxes. He's going to have Warren Buffett's secretary up there. This whole notion that he's going to use her and to make this point about fairness. And I don't see a lot of detail though, because fairness is in the eye of the beholder. You got 47 people in the country who don't pay no income tax. They do pay Social Security taxes, and that's part of the Warren Buffett secretary problem. I don't know if this president is prepared to say to somebody like Mitt Romney, yes, your income comes from capital gains and dividends to a significant degree. Interest is different. Those two are taxed at 15%. I don't know if he's prepared to say we need to change that rate and double it or treat that like normal income, because he would run into a big problem with a lot of Democrats who have this deep faith in low taxation of capital gains and dividends. What he may do is say, my God, the Republicans want to make the problem even worse.
Al,
I think that the key here, maybe, not just for this speech, but on the line, is to start using the phrase tax reform. Republicans are using the term tax reform. We have been so divided over tax cuts and tax increases and all of that. If we could start talking about tax reform, you'd end up having your fights behind it will be pretty much the same. But you're at least not using as the headline something that is offending a whole bunch of other people.
Bob?
So I think he should probably talk about tax reform.
Bob?
Well, I suspect that without trying to be specific, we're not going to hear much new about how to solve the problems we've got in this country. Because everybody on the Hill and everybody in the administration knows what the range of solutions are on almost any problem you can name. And they've all been discussed for the last, several years at least. Whether we're talking Social Security, health care, taxes, regulations, whatever. Everybody understands the framework of how you have to solve these problems. So I don't think anything's going to be new. I hope that what he tries to say is we got to solve the problems. We got to get at it. Now, I don't know what he's going to say, but I would think that he's got to talk about the jobs again. He's got to talk about some specifics, but he's also got to encourage the country and encourage the Congress to get off their duff and get the job done. And the country has to understand we're going to be changing some things. I'm not sure how far he's going to go in this area, but there's nothing new here.
But Al, can the president take all of this and then separate himself or define himself against a rabid GOP?
Well, he has to if he's going to get reelected. And I think in part...
Well, he still has to come out of a 38% approval rating, too. I think that's his first hurdle. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, sure. But what you said is he's got to achieve that in some fashion between now and the election. But I think there are opportunities to do that.
Ralph, I think one thing he may seriously consider is talking about forgiveness of student loans. I mean, especially with younger people that have been strongly supportive of him and are somewhat disillusioned because their financial situation hasn't improved under his leadership, per se. Student loan forgiveness could be a major issue to get their vote. Whether he raises that in the State of the Union, we don't know. But down the line, that could be something to really bring young people into line to support him again.
Alan, is that something that the president may pull out of the bag of tricks?
I would be very surprised. I think that would just be raw meat for Republicans. The notion that people are lucky enough to go to college who signed up to pay something off should then have it forgiven, I think is dangerous territory. It's not something that I'm aware of that they're talking about. It's something that a lot of young people without jobs are talking about because they got these promises, these commitments that they made. But if he wants to vote,
he's going to have to.
Well, I don't see a lot of stomach for that on either side of the political aisle.
This is an idea. I have no idea whether it has ever crossed the mind of anybody at the White House. We have a terrible infrastructure problem, and it's terrible because our bridges are falling down and our highways are crumbling and so forth. But one of the big problems about that is that's also been where all the pork has come from. And the Public Works Committee is famous for bridges to nowhere and so forth. If the president were to propose that a commission be established, and I need more explanation of that, but not here, but a commission with some objectivity that could prioritize the public works that need to be attended to, and so that you're doing what you need to do with this money, and then provide the money even under our current problems, because there are a lot of jobs that are associated with infrastructure work.
But Bob, wouldn't the GOP would obviously glom onto, and I don't disagree with what Al's saying, we've got a definite problem in infrastructure here, and we definitely need to invest as a country in infrastructure, but it seems to me that the GOP would probably glom onto that and say, oh great, another stimulus package. It's stimulus 2.0. Is that a possibility?
Well, it depends on what you did. Now, let's go a bit step further in that. What if he said, in effect, we are going to deal with one infrastructure situation. We're going to get the interstate commerce, the interstate highway system, back up to par. Now, that's a pretty clean piece of business. I mean, you know, you're not talking about new structures or all these kind of problems. You got something very clear. We're trying to fix the interstate highway system. That would be a lot of jobs. You spend a lot of money doing it, and I don't think anybody would disagree with that. Once you start getting into picking projects, you run into some problems that are sometimes difficult. But if you're talking about something as well respected as interstate highway system, you may be able to put a bipartisan effort together on it.
Alan.
As long as you don't figure a way to pay for it. I mean, I think there's a large appetite for infrastructure spending and little appetite for infrastructure spending without some way to pay for it, and little appetite for any of the options. The obvious way, if you want to fix the interstate highway system, is to increase the gas tax. And there is no appetite for that. It would have a whole host of benefits. Plenty of people have outlined and described those benefits. More expensive gas means less driving, that's a good thing. More expensive gas means more tax revenue you can use to improve the highways and or bridges. And yet there's a lot of resistance. We spend billions and billions a year on infrastructure. We probably need to spend twice what we're spending, but you can't just do it in a vacuum. You got to have some way to pay for it.
Bob,
I don't disagree with Alan, but wouldn't you think that is one of the few projects, if you proposed it correctly, even if you said we're going to have a small gasoline tax and say, let the public get a feel for it, I think that may be one of the few things that you could get some bipartisan support for.
Well, you would think. I certainly have my support, but this gets raised year after year after year and gets shot down.
But they don't get tied together.
No, they do get tied together. The gas tax goes into
the public trust fund. Yeah, that's right. But I don't think the public generally puts it together. If you say we are going to have a 7 cents a gallon increase in the federal gas tax, every penny is going to the interstate highway system improvement, which we all know all over the country
but
needs improvement.
That screams of trust fund, which the GOP is just going to go absolutely berserk over.
We have that today. People propose to expand it, and it gets shot down. There's nothing new there. I mean, I'm all for it, but there's so much resistance to increases in the gas tax.
I agree with you that the public doesn't put it together very well. But I think if the president stood up and said, we're raising the tax, and this is what it's going to do specifically, no other project, I think it might work.
If he laid it out there, he laid it out there that way, maybe.
No,
I don't know.
I don't either, but I'd like to try it.
It would be good to try, but Al, again, you're talking about a president with 38% approval rating. I keep going back to that because that's a huge number that he's looking at. And you're also looking at a general electorate that's going to the pump and paying now back up to $4 a gallon for gas. Is that something that can be sold from the Democratic standpoint?
I think if you included in this some private enterprise, as we're doing out here on the Beltway and what have you, I'm talking about toll roads and that kind of thing, do that where it makes sense. Don't do it where it doesn't make sense. And that ought to please Republicans. It helps just find the money to pay for it, and it gets the job done. So I would think that would be innovative and possibly you could get by with it.
Well, this administration has been talking about public-private partnerships for a while and has not taken hold. I mean, you want to look at the public-private partnership, all you have to mention is one word, Solyndra, and everybody starts to cringe. Can we get somewhere, going off of Bob, what you were saying, can we get somewhere that can maybe connect the dots in a speech that has to go less than the record an hour, 26 minutes that Clinton did in his last State of the Union address as president?
Well, I have the foggiest idea whether this thing would fly or not. But if you're looking for something that is doable, both from the standpoint if it's a good project, and if you tie both a moderately increase in the tax and you specifically say that every penny goes to the interstate highway system and you lock things in like that, I think you probably have a better chance than you do when you just say, well, we're going to invest in infrastructure. What the blank does that mean to a lot of people? What they can really understand is the highway outside of my yard that I use when I go to work, that's going to get better. That makes some sense.
Alan,
we have a highway trust fund. It gets its money from the gas tax. It goes to interstate highways. It may also include state highways. When you start messing with it, a couple things happen. One, you bring in more revenue, and people resent that a lot. But what you do, the smart way to do it, though, is then to say, okay, we're going to spend the money where it's needed. And that isn't always where the money comes from. So you've got areas where people drive a lot, would pay a lot of taxes, and the highways are in good shape, and they would discover that the money they were paying in higher taxes isn't going to their roads in that state. It's going somewhere else where, admittedly, the needs are greater. It's just hard and complicated, and people try it over
and
over again.
And it screams of pork.
That isn't to say, well, it's not so much that it's pork, but people say, I don't want to pay a higher tax, and I really don't want to pay a higher tax if that money is going to go to road 1,000 miles from here that's not going to help me in any way, shape, or form. Now, having said that, this idea comes up again and again. The president's got to have some specifics, and he may have the specific. Maybe at some point, if the highways are in bad enough shape everywhere, people say, my God, let me pay a higher gasoline tax, because right now they're destroying my car with all these potholes. And it's a lot cheaper to pay 50 cents more a gallon than to pay $500 to have the undercarriage of my car repaired.
Now, I hate to agree with Alan. And not because I hate to agree with Alan, but because I hate the fact that this is true. Let's take Seattle. I know that well. Seattle has got some of the worst traffic in the country. At least for 30 or 35 years, they have been trying to pass a program that will take care of the problem, and it has been voted down time and time again. The guy in Seattle who is sitting there in a parking lot trying to get to work will bitch and moan about it, but he won't let his taxes be increased in order to solve the problem. And that's what Alan was basically saying.
Well, and that is that.
Go ahead, Bob.
Well, that happens to be true in a lot of ways. And I'm not suggesting that this is going to necessarily work. I'm trying to suggest that the only way that you're going to be able to develop, get more jobs is put some money into some programs. And for the most part, that's going to be very hard to do because somebody's always going to complain. But the one thing about using the money strictly for the existing interstate highway system and fixing a lot of the problems that it has today, not new places, not new bridges, not anything, just the highway system structures we know it today, make it as good as it was 25 years ago. That might be able to be done. I don't know if it can or not.
Ralph.
I think, unfortunately, you're going to have to have some sort of major infrastructure problem before you get consensus among the American people. They just feel like the taxes have been raised too high and they're hurting economically.
Or we need to run a list of all of the ones that have already happened. Bridges
right.
that have fallen down and disasters
right.
that have
But something occurred. In the news that catches people's attention to that effect.
Yeah, you're going to have to sell it, but there are ways to sell it.
We have a long list of disasters.
No kidding.
That are citable, and everybody's had pothole problems. And I'll mention one final problem here. With if you get increase money from all gas and spend it only on the interstate highway system, no, that's fine if you use the interstate highway system. Everybody pays the tax. A lot of people drive around town. They never get on the freeway. They never get on the interstate. They're not even close to the interstate. And it's the same issue. Why do I have to pay when they're going to fix up this highway? How about the money I pay going to my highway, the road I take down to get to work? I don't get on the interstate.
Well, that brings up a good point. But looking at some of the other options that the president can come out of the hammock with, one of them would be, and this is something that CNN reported earlier, is funding for clean energy. CNN is reporting today that the president is talking about bringing up clean energy again, which to me, even if it's just incentives, is just an absolute dice roll as far as political crisis or political success. Does that make sense?
Well, he couldn't get it through the Senate. I'll tell you why. There's at least a dozen Democratic senators who have coal all over their states, and they're
right.
not going to go for that. So pick something that'll work.
But again, I mean, just off of the fact that the Democratic senators who have coal, natural gas, et cetera, in their districts, just the fact that he would do this in the same calendar year as the Solyndra buildup, Al, does that make political sense?
Solyndra was unfortunate. Let me respond with something else. We keep saying these things are politically impossible because the people won't go along with it. At some point, and our group is as good a one as any because none of us are running for office, at some point you got to say the people of this country have got to get real. They want good highways. They don't want to pay for them. They want medical care of top quality and inexpensively. They don't want to pay for it. And they bitch and moan about the Congress they've got. Well, somebody voted those people in. And I think at some point we need to start talking. We need to start talking to the American public about you can't sit there on your hands and say, I want all of this and I don't want to pay for it.
Bob?
Isn't listening to the truth revealing?
Well, it is. I mean, you know, the reality dictates, and I agree with Al. I mean, at some point, there's got to be an inherent personal responsibility in how you're governed. We've been saying this on this show for over a year, that the general electorate has to have some skin in the game. And the only way to get skin in the game is to take a concerted effort to find out and talk about the way you're governed. You know what? The view from the cheap seats are always somewhat good. But unless you're actually on the floor in the game, and by being in the game, that means getting involved, writing your members of Congress, telling them what I'd be willing to pay my fair share for, there is a definite lack of that. But the reality is, that is something that we're trying to change as a group here on Backroom Politics and in the First Congress Society. But we can do that. Can the president take the opportunity in the bully pulpit to maybe strike that message into the hearts of the American public tonight? Alan, I'll ask you.
He's got to try. And we can talk ourselves out of why any particular proposal won't work. He's had a lot of them out there. He's backed away from some. He's succeeded with others. And I think we're going to hear some familiar themes. And he's going to have to put it in a little different context, this political context we talked about earlier, and make it clear that he's got his nose to the grindstone, he's paying attention, he's still working hard to come up with good ideas that will sell to members of Congress and to the American people. And we can pick apart any individual idea, and so will his people. But he doesn't have any choice. He's got to come up with a lot of ideas.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
We've got a caller on the line. Perfect. Caller, in the 727 area code, you're on the air. Caller?
Somebody needs to ask the president, how come he only give 1% of his money to charity? I mean, that's pretty pathetic of somebody who wants to tell everybody else how to spend their money, how much money they should give the government, and everybody paying their fair share. The guy's never given to charity. He's the stingiest person I've ever seen in my life.
Alan, you have a response to that?
Well, I was actually looking at this very question today because obviously Mitt Romney gives almost 14-15% of his income to charity. But what Obama's history is a little bit different than the way the reader states. Prior to coming to the Senate and writing those books, he was in fact giving in the 1% range, which made him very generous compared, I might say, to Joe Biden and Al Gore, who gave considerably less than that, less than 1%. But once he wrote those books, and then when he became president and wrote the books, he's now giving 5 or 6% to charity. So he has dramatically changed his behavior. He's not up in the league of a Mitt Romney, but he's well ahead of the average American, who gives on the average about 3%.
Right. Caller, thanks for your call. We got 5 minutes left in this segment, and I want to make, before we go on to the GOP ticket and GOP politics, I do want to point out one thing. Tonight, on the floor in the joint session for the State of the Union address, Congresswoman Gabby Giffords is going to be there in her last appearance on the floor of Congress as a seated member of Congress. I want to just say just a couple of things. First of all, her courage, her motivation, and what she's done for the people of her district and the people of the state of Arizona is amazing. Her ability to overcome tragedy and continue to just focus on doing good for not only herself and getting herself well, taking care of her family, but also her consistent support of the people of her district there in Tucson is just amazing. And I think we're losing one of the really good, solid people in Congress when we see Gabby Giffords leave the floor today. Al?
I would add to that I think she probably could be reelected. From what we've seen of her public appearances and what have you, she really isn't yet capable of doing the job. And for her to recognize that fact and resign is another act of principle.
And courage.
And courage. I've said it and I'm about to repeat myself.
Alan?
It's interesting. We talked about the human props that the president will have up in the gallery, and yet the most dramatic moment is going to be when she comes into the room, when the president goes to greet her. She has a magical presence, and she's an inspiration to everybody. Every time you see her on TV, you remember those days. You look at her, you just think how remarkable it is that she is even alive and functioning and improving. As Al says, she's clearly not up to the task, and it had to be a difficult decision. It's hard to argue that it wasn't the right decision, but she's a wonderful inspiration, and I hope we hear more from her in other venues and other ways down the road. But it may have a calming effect on the mood tonight, because you cannot see her and think about her without reflecting on your own lives.
I mean, you know, the one thing I will say about Congresswoman Giffords is, you know, one of the issues that in my other life outside of backroom politics, very strong in homeland security and border security issues. She has been an absolute stalwart, and, you know, has literally crossed the aisle many times to try and make border security a true issue, to the point where I got to give the president and Speaker Boehner in particular props for taking up Gabby Giffords' border security bill. I think that bodes well and says a lot about what bipartisanship can do. Ralph, you had a thought?
I was just going to say, she, in her work as a legislator, she always was willing to work with the other side to get things done, and I think she's a very courageous woman, and I hope she takes some time off and then runs for election, because I definitely think she's a tremendous asset.
One person who I believe will not be on the floor also is, our thoughts and our prayers are going out to Senator Mark Kirk. Senator Kirk suffered a stroke over the weekend. He will not be on the floor today. I believe he's still hospitalized, stabilized, I believe. But our thoughts and prayers go out to really one of the good guys. I mean, he's definitely a staunch Republican, but we want to give a shout-out to Senator Mark Kirk, his family, staff, and friends. Anyways, when we come back, it's going to be happy hour. That means we're going to have alcohol, we're going to have cigars, we're going to be talking about GOP politics. That means we're going to talk about a whole slew of mess.
And boy, are we going to have fun.
Oh, it's going to be a good one. Get some alcohol in us and watch what happens. By the way, this is Backroom Politics, live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us.
Thank you. down, 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 down.
Room 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. We're talking about the State of the Union pregame in our earlier segment, but we got a call on the line. Caller, you're on the air with Backroom Politics.
Hi, just from the last segment?
Yes. What's your question, caller?
Caller, are you there?
Yeah, I'm getting feedback.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, caller.
Just a point of information for you. A third of the Highway Trust Fund monies of the $243 billion that's... $78 billion has gone for purposes other than highway bridges.
Caller, we seem to have a bad connection. I think we got the gist of your point, and we're going to talk about that. You can listen in, continue listening in, caller. Thanks for the call. He's got a point. I mean, when we talk about trust funds, especially the Highway Trust Fund, we're talking about a fund that has been pillaged many times to pay for a multitude of things, not necessarily all related to the interstate highway system. I don't know if the caller's figure of 3, 5, or 20% is accurate, but there is a substantial amount of money that's been used as a bank account for Congress for a while. Alan, you've been around that trust fund there. Is that accurate?
You know, I don't have the statistics. I wouldn't myself call it something that's been pillaged by the Congress. They it's a lot of money, and they like to try to direct it in different ways. But it's you do so to some extent at your own peril. I just don't remember the things that can qualify for funding. But it's not that somebody is somehow. Whatever redirection or earmarking has occurred in the past, we've moved further and further away from that. I'm in no position to dispute the caller's numbers. I can't confirm or anything, but the point's well taken that it's not just interstate highway. It may not be just highway. It may not be just highway and bridges. I just don't have the facts.
Yeah. Bob, I mean, you heard the caller, and the caller's got a good point. Is there a way for us to truly secure a trust fund for intended purposes rather than having it be a little side bank note or a credit card for other programs?
Well, there's a way to do it. The question is,
Will Congress do it?
And the answer to that is usually no.
Can you attach some sort of penalty if the money is used for something other than infrastructure?
Not one that you can't undo.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. We're going to talk a little bit about some GOP politics now.
I was just looking this up apparently there are three different. The Highway Trust Fund is three different funds. One is for highways and bridges. One is for mass transit, which gets people off the highways, and the third is for underground storage tank cleanup.
Right.
Which is also associated with gasoline.
Right.
I think that's I'm going to guess that's fairly accurate. I think we should be careful tossing around suggestions that it's some sort of piggy bank that where money gets spent well beyond that. The guardians of that fund and the committees in Congress and so on and all of the people who are in the construction business pay close attention, and you don't just get to go dip in and send it off to some favorite idea.
Agreed, but I will say from personal experience, I've seen it at the federal level, it is extremely prominent at the state level where they have trust funds like this. These trust funds have riders, amendments, the appropriations bills usually say we'll pay for this out of the highway trust fund or the general transportation trust fund. Those trust funds get used quite a bit, from my own personal experience.
Fine, but I think we shouldn't read state experiences overlay that.
I hear you. That's a good point. That's a very good point. Back to GOP politics. Back to something a lot more,
juicy.
Juicy. More reality TV based.
A frothy mix
of activity. Wow, that's the second week in a row. Nice job, Alan. Way to go. Frothy mix, he loves that.
He does keep it alive.
He does keep it alive. We're going to talk about the frothy mix that was South Carolina. For those of you who might have been under a rock, you might have not seen that Newt Gingrich pulled out a substantial win. 40% to low 20s for 28% for Mitt Romney, but that 40% number is a big number for Newt. Contrary to everybody's belief, this man still has life in a campaign. Bob, would you have predicted such a strong win for Newt in South Carolina, even with him supposedly "quote unquote" creeping up in the polls?
Only if I had been well into my cups.
Okay, there's that. I'm going to let that stand for a second. Alan, could you have predicted that?
Listen, 1 week ago today, we had a chance. Not a small
one
of us did. We weren't even close. We were talking about what would likely happen if Romney squeaked out what we thought would be his third straight victory. Well, it turns out his week was so bad that he lost twice.
Twice.
He lost Iowa, and he got killed in South Carolina. Now, remember, it was last Tuesday, the day of the Tuesday night debate, and then a following debate, and Gingrich continued to show, A, how good he is in debates, and B, how lucky he is
in debate.
When you throw those two things together, and oh my God, he had a monster week. And we also learned, as we have come to believe, that going into the polls, going right up to the polls, a lot of people haven't made up their mind. A lot of people made up their mind late, and they all moved. They moved to Newt, and some of the people who were going to go another direction went to Newt. Perry got out, and probably they all went to Newt. I mean, it was a huge week for him.
Al, does the fact that Newt pulled out such a strong win, I mean, let's be honest, South Carolina is slightly right of center than most of our traditional Republican voters. They are strongly conservative, very much religious. There's a strong religious right in South Carolina. But as a Democrat, do you sleep better at night after Newt's win last week, thinking that we might get another 4 years in the White House?
I start to sleep better, and then I think he might become president, and then I can't sleep for the rest of the night.
Neither can a lot of Republicans.
But that brings up a good question. I mean, this is a guy who, up until last week, was literally running a campaign on six figures.
Right.
Literally did not have a sustainable campaign infrastructure in any state, let alone South Carolina. Did the debate win the South Carolina primary?
Angel out of Las Vegas won it.
Ralph,
the number one issue was electability, and that's among half of South Carolina voters. They all went with Gingrich. Late deciders also broke heavily with the former speaker. And what's interesting is Romney may have been hurt by the fact that he's still perceived as being a moderate, and the fact that he is Mormon among South Carolina voters. The fact that the talk about his commitments to tithe to the LDS Church. It shouldn't make a difference, but for some reason in South Carolina, that seemed to be an issue.
Well, let's talk about, I mean, the big ticket item that everybody was talking about was the strong performance of Newt Gingrich in the debates in South Carolina versus the somewhat lackluster performance of Mitt Romney in the debates in South Carolina. Again, I go to the question, Bob, did the debate win South Carolina for Newt Gingrich?
I think the debates lost South Carolina for Romney. I think his performance,
really?
I think his performance in those two debates with respect primarily to his taxes was a serious, serious faux pas. And quite frankly, it's hard to believe that a person who has been in public life, and he's been governor of this major state, wouldn't have recognized that he was going to have to be able to say clearly, you know, what his tax situation was, and say it in a way that, look, you can make all kinds of good arguments. Here's a guy who's been an entrepreneur. There are a lot of companies that he has helped grow and strengthen, and they have become very successful, and he's owned stock in it, and that's why he has a good fortune. But it's also that he has created jobs. It's also true that some of the companies that he invested in failed. Okay, fine. But the fact of the matter is, he has yet to be able to say to the public, this is what an entrepreneur does, this is what I did. I'm a successful investor in many projects, and some I've not. I've been very fortunate. My taxes are paid the same way anybody else, including Warren Buffett, you know, gets his money, investments that are successful. And I don't, you know, it's nice to be able to do that.
Now,
the fact of the matter is, he hasn't been able to do it, and that's why Gingrich was so easy. It was so easy for him to be successful.
It almost seemed like Mitt Romney was almost awkward or uncomfortable being in such a Bible Belt state. Am I the only one who got that?
I didn't get that. I think he's very uncomfortable talking about himself, and he's very uncomfortable being the aggressor. It's obvious that Romney and his team made some calculated decisions long ago, months ago, based on a lot of history. That you get ahead of the game, you organize, you watch polls, you don't make mistakes, you have good solid performances, you watch other people rise and fall, rise again in the case of Gingrich. And I think what happened is they were planning to release tax returns at an appropriate point, an appropriate number of years. They were not ready to do it right now, this last week, and they looked ridiculous in the preparation. Had Gingrich not defied all of the odds, showed he had a still another life, more lives than a cat, this guy, no one would have questioned their tactic. But with Gingrich coming on gangbusters, Romney looked like a bit of, like a deer in the headlights, unprepared, and you add those two things together, up for Gingrich, down for Romney, that accounts for the 12-point difference. That's a huge difference. I don't know whether it was if Romney had done better and got his taxes out, and if Gingrich hadn't gotten so lucky with the John King question on the wives, maybe it would have been a lot closer. I don't know who would have won, but you throw that stuff into the mix, and it certainly contributed to the huge margin victory.
And when you have a fellow that is reluctant, as Romney is, to go for the jugular, put up against Gingrich, who loves blood, who goes hammer and tong and uses the broadsword, It really puts Romney at a disadvantage.
And Romney should be going after Gingrich's supposed conservative credentials by talking about the fact that supposedly Gingrich sat down with Nancy Pelosi and was talking about climate change. And then,
not supposedly.
No,
yeah.
It's not.
Right.
It was
right.
On TV. It was
right.
An ad.
Right.
Let's look at.
But he needs to go on the attack and really go after Gingrich, claiming he's not a conservative, because that's Romney's problem. He's still perceived as a moderate.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the, I mean, Newt Gingrich came out and called the president a food stamp president at a gathering in South Carolina. And yet, when Juan Williams brought it up, Newt was offended. Newt was absolutely dumbfounded. How dare you bring up that question, Juan? This is not the appropriate time. First of all, I'm surprised it wasn't a bigger issue. The fact, I mean, the only thing he didn't do was say another derogatory term about the president. Am I wrong in this, Alan?
No. I think that what was different about last night's debate was he didn't go after the moderator, which he has been doing with some regularity. Whenever he gets into a tight place, he attacks the person who asked the question.
Well, Brian Williams is really good, though. Alan.
Yeah, on the food stamp president issue, Gingrich has been using that term for weeks. Juan Williams called, asked about it in a way that said, is there something racial beneath this question? Allowing Gingrich, A, to be super indignant, say, how dare you, how dare you, how dare you, and then to say, and it is a fact, that we have the highest number of food stamp recipients today.
Are African American.
No. It's not our African American. We have the highest number of food stamp recipients today ever.
Oh, okay.
This is the food stamp president. It wasn't about race. It was about the numbers. Now, of course we have the highest number because the economy has been in the toilet. We've got unemployment measured at close to 9% and real unemployment considerably higher. We have modified that program a little bit, making it a little bit more generous, and a lot of people signed up for it and are getting benefits. So now, what he's implying in it is this is a guy who would rather give federal benefits to people than jobs. It wasn't about race. It was a heavy-duty accusation, but that's what allowed him to put Juan Williams down with it. He is a master at pivoting and turning on the questioner or the accuser. If it's the media, it's the questioner. If it's one of the other people up there, that's the accuser. And he changes the subject and he attacks, and the other people aren't as used to it. He's used to going for blood. These other guys aren't, as Al said.
Well, but that comment alone, I mean, that comment sparked a whole mess of retaliation from the Dems and those inside the ballot, even from some of his GOP colleagues saying that statement alone, calling President Obama a food stamp president, was not only inappropriate, but it had undertones. The perception was he was playing to a large base in a southern state.
Perception may be fine. He hasn't run from it. He's using it every day. And he says, and here's the fact, it's got nothing to do with race. It's got to do with the president's view of what the government's role should be. And he has made that work for him. And I think these other guys overreached.
Is that an accurate approach, Bob?
Time will tell. I don't know.
Gingrich is going to alienate moderates and independents with that kind of rhetoric.
The word demagogue just kind of hangs in the air.
I will tell you right now, Newt Gingrich, in the GOP, I mean, I remember a time when Ronald Reagan was running for president against George Bush, and that was Republican politics 101. You don't come out and grossly attack your fellow Republicans. There's no civility in that. There's no honor in that. Newt Gingrich arguably has shown zero civility in dealing with his opponents. Would you call that accurate, Al?
Yeah, I think that's accurate. He has always gone after his opponents with a hammer and tong. And remember, the reason that the cameras, special orders is a special thing that Congress does. Once it's finished its business, then any member can get up and speak for an hour on any topic he wants. Gingrich came to the floor denouncing Democrats on, I have no memory of the topic, but he started asking questions, you know, and saying, do you, Democrats, what is your response? Well, as I thought, you have none. Well, Tip O'Neill was sitting in his office and knew that there's nobody around on the floor when you're giving these
monologues.
Monologues. And he was asking questions of people who weren't there. This is a man whose ethics are in question, and demagogue is, I think, the appropriate word to apply to those kind of tactics.
Now, what surprises? Oh, Alan, go ahead.
Well, I don't particularly like the term food stamp president. I don't see it as demagoguery in that sense. It's definitely provocative. But it's a shorthand for saying, as I said before, here's a guy of this contrast between an opportunity society or an entitlement society. Are we going to give people an opportunity to get jobs, or are we going to give them government handouts that are paid for by a redistribution of income? Now, there are other possible interpretations, and that's where Juan Williams was trying to go, but I think Newt Gingrich was ready for that question. And in this particular case, he's not running from that particular phrase because it's a convenient way, and if it's controversial, fine. I don't think that particular one is going to charge up the
well,
Republican.
We'll charge up the Republican base.
Republican moderates, they'll look upon it. They might say, I'd rather, we talked about it in a different way. When Romney makes that point, it's opportunity society versus entitlement society, which is a more civilized, pleasant way to make what I think is the same point. Newt's way is much more provocative. Go for the jugular. See if you can get under people's skin. Get them to react. It's not the worst kind of demagoguery. We don't need to argue over
Ralph. But if Gingrich becomes the Republican nominee, how is he going to backtrack and be able to get moderates, independents, to vote for him in order for a Republican candidate to win?
Well, to Alan's point, he's the master of that. He's done that all his career. He's banking on the fact that the general electorate has a short attention span. He has great sound bites for 30 seconds, and then 6 months down the road, they forget
about
it.
But his negatives are too high.
Apparently not. He won South Carolina.
I'm talking about in a general election.
Now,
I mean,
that's going to be interesting.
You know, it's got a very high negative.
You know,
Bob.
You know what's really interesting to me is the difference between the way Ronald Reagan, talked conservative, and the way Gingrich does. Reagan was trying to say, he often said, you know, he talked about welfare queens. But he always smiled about it. He was never mean-spirited about it. He was always trying to say, we got to find ways to solve these problems. Gingrich goes in there with a hacksaw, whacking people over the head, and in effect saying, you know, it isn't just that, you know, you're a welfare person. It's that's bad. You're not a good person if you're doing that. That's the way he leaves people to believe. And it is so difficult for me to see how long term something like that is going to help the Republican Party win an election.
But this is a guy who talks about jobs, economy is the big problem. Has Newt Gingrich defined his approach to create new jobs? Al, I ask you that question. From a Democratic side, have you seen it?
No.
Alan, have you seen it?
Not at all.
But again, he talks about it. I guess the bigger question is there substance behind Newt Gingrich's campaign?
And that's what Romney is going to say. No, he's worked as a lobbyist in D.C. He's never created a job in the private sector. Look, Newt is a very smart guy. We've talked about this at some length in just terms of sheer brain power. He's a guy who's an idea minute. There was a great observation that Bob Dole once made, though, about all of this. He made this years ago. He said, you go and you talk with Newt, and I've spent a lot of time talking to him, and it's just an idea minute, idea. He says, the guy's got he's got five file cabinets. Cabinet number one, full of Newt's ideas. Cabinet number two, Newt's ideas. Cabinet number three, Newt's ideas. Cabinet number four, Newt's ideas. The fifth cabinet is a really little one. That's Newt's good ideas. Well, he's creative. He comes up, but that's sort of the point, that Newt's a smart guy. He's a clever guy. He plays dirty. He can be charming. And you never know quite what to think. And when I watch him, and I'm amazed that he's had, you know, multiple lives in this particular campaign, and yet nobody ever thought that Dick Nixon, of all people, would become president.
True.
Nobody thought Jimmy Carter would become president.
Again, true.
Nobody thought that George Bush, 43, would be reelected president, or even the first time elected. And weird things happen in American politics. So I still don't think Newt will get the nomination, but he might. And if he gets the nomination in a bad economy and he's pretty clever, I don't know that he can't win. But, you know, I don't think we should sell short his brain power, the sort of ideas he has. Now, he's got this grandiose sense of self. There was a great exchange when Santorum said, well, on the subject of grandiosity, Newt's got that. And Newt doesn't take the bait. He comes back and says, this is a grandiose country. Well, grandiose, the term, usually means
something
huge, something excessive, something exaggerated. And that's what Santorum meant, but Newt was able to sort of turn it around. We're a grand country.
Yeah. Wow.
And so he's good on his feet. One of the things I worry about with all these debates is I don't want us to elect the best debater. I want us to elect the best leader, the one we can feel most comfortable with, the one who's strongest, stable, and so on. And that's where Newt comes up short. But
that begs the question, Bob. Go ahead.
Think about some of the best presidents that we have had in our lifetime. Harry Truman was not a great speaker.
No.
Eisenhower was not
a great
speaker.
But could he solve problems? That's the bottom line.
The problem is these were solid guys who knew how to solve problems and get things done. What we're looking for is someone who can lead the Congress and lead the country, help the public to understand what the solutions are and what we have to do. Now, that doesn't, you know, all these huge, big ideas that Newt has are irrelevant to the problem. There is nobody on Capitol Hill who doesn't know how to solve the problem of Social Security and programs. The entitlement programs have to be reformed. Everybody knows it up there. It's a question of whether you have the ability and the willpower and the guts to do it. Everybody understands we have to make some cuts in the Defense Department. Okay, fine. The question is, how do we do it? Everybody understands most of the solutions to almost any problem we have on Capitol Hill within the government programs. The question is not the knowledge of how to do it. We don't need grandiose ideas. We need somebody who can lead the country to say, you're right, we have to solve these problems. This is how we have to do it. We're not going to have to nail anybody real hard. We're going to work out a system that we take a little bit out of every little piece, and so nobody gets really hurt, but the systems are sound, and we can go forward, and our grandkids know the programs are going to be there and strong for them.
Now, I want to ask you a question. Based off of South Carolina, because in the next segment we're going to talk about Florida, which turns everything on its head that we're talking about right now. In South Carolina, did Newt Gingrich did he appear presidential?
No, I don't think so much he appeared presidential. He appeared to want it more, and he was able to speak to that particular audience in ways they best understood it compared to everybody else.
And Ron,
Alan?
Well, I don't know what it means. He got 40% of the vote of the Republican Party, the people who voted for him. This is not a surprise. I think it's not necessarily cause and effect. Also, we're going to say, yeah, I think he's got the best chance to win. You know, whether the same people said the same thing a week earlier, who knows? I think they like the guy better. They like the thought of him debating the president. They thought, we need somebody really strong who will take it to the president. And for them, that's presidential. For some of the rest of the people in the country, not so much. But it wasn't like the other three were presidential and Newt wasn't. So, you know, you got to hand it to him.
Al,
I've always believed that nobody looks presidential until they become the president. We are easy, and comfortable in saying President Obama. We weren't. A, he was elected. I mean, it didn't triple on the tongue the way it should. We were still doing
President Bush.
President Bush. That sounded right. That didn't, and that, you know, and so I think he did not look presidential. He looked dominating. And some people will interpret that as leadership. And some people won't.
Bob, last comment.
I think what's most interesting of all the numbers I've seen coming out of the review of the Carolina election was that Speaker Gingrich was seen as more presidential by, 57% of the voters as opposed to 31 or 2 or 3 for Mr. Romney. Now, of course, Romney had a bad night. But the idea that you look presidential... operating the way Gingrich did during the debate is surprising, because rather than appearing to be statesmanlike and presidential, he was going for the gut. And if that's what people in South Carolina think is presidential, that's kind of an interesting thought.
That is an interesting thought.
And I was surprised that the number was that large. It was almost a 20-point difference.
Yeah.
And it probably happened in, 3 or 4 days?
Yes. Yeah. Arguably, within the week, he was neck and neck.
Yeah.
Within 3 days, he was above.
Yeah.
Let's focus a little bit. We're going to take this. South Carolina, a huge win for Newt, no question. Now, Florida? Florida's another story. Newt's got himself a little bit of a race going down there in Florida, but Newt's made some big gaffes, similar to the tax question. Mitt Romney did not approach the tax question very well. He bobbled it, he fumbled it, not really his best moment in the debates. When we come back, we're going to talk about Florida and how Florida might turn the tide. One organization or one group of reporters is saying Florida is Armageddon. We're going to talk about Armageddon when we come back. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Back Room in Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us. Programming note real quick. tonight here at Shelley's Back Room in downtown Washington, D.C., is a cigar and scotch tasting starting at 6 o'clock. It is $50, including tax and tip. You can come down and sample La Felina cigars and a wide variety of scotches. It is fantastic. So if you're here, we'd love to have you down here. We got a caller on the line. Caller, you're on the air with Backroom Politics.
Yes, the caller that solved the Skype audio problem. Bob has the email with the data to Tom Colburn that shows that a third of the money from the highway trust funds goes to projects other than highways.
Okay, very good. We thank you for the call, caller.
Thank you, Rich.
Thanks, Rich. Let's talk a little bit about Florida and what's going on down in Florida. The situation down there is kind of turning a little bit almost in favor of Mitt Romney. The debate last night was a big telltale sign. The question that everybody's been asking is, was Newt Gingrich riding too much of a high? Was he sitting back on his laurels based on his approach for last night? Bob, you saw the debate last night.
I don't think he was. I'm surprised that he was as moderately, you know, moderate in his tone as he was. I think maybe he was just, you know, seeing where the waters were. But I think it's, you know, Florida's interesting state. The northern tier of counties going, you know, from the Atlantic Ocean over to the Panhandle is a pretty conservative area.
Yeah.
And the southern part, the southern third of the quarter of the state is
much more moderate and liberal.
Yeah. And I guess probably two-thirds of Democrats live in the bottom third of the state.
Correct.
The middle of the state, running, you know,
the I-4 corridor.
I-4, right. You know, running from the east coast to the west coast, so about 50 miles on each side, is where about at least half the voters are in the state.
Right.
And that's probably where Romney has to do well. If he doesn't do well there, I don't know that it'll be all over for him, but he certainly is in trouble. But remind yourself, February is not a big month for primaries and caucuses. I'm only sure about two of them. I know Nevada,
right,
and I know Michigan.
Michigan has one.
Are both in the first half of February.
Correct.
And then there's nothing till the very end.
Right.
And then we go into Super Tuesday. So, from my standpoint, if I'm looking at this and evaluating what's going to happen, if Romney and Gingrich are about even in Florida, then we're going to go on to, in the first half of February, we're going to two states, one a caucus state, Nevada, which is small, one a primary state, which is big, Michigan. Both of them, I would think, would favor Mr. Romney. But that assumes something. That assumes that he comes back from the problems that he had in South Carolina, and he does well in Florida, at least as well, if not better, than Gingrich. If they come in about even, you know, we're going to move on. If either one of them gets ahead, that's an advantage.
I mean,
but if he wins Florida, I think that pushes Newt back down.
Arguably, Alan, Florida is more of a snapshot of the general electorate. You have the large urban areas in Palm Beach, Broward, Miami-Dade, Hillsborough, Orange, and up towards Jacksonville. And then yet you also have the agricultural center going up through Ocala and going up towards the Georgia border and along the Panhandle. Everybody has said in the past two elections, everything was Florida, Florida, Florida. How important is Florida, not only to the GOP ticket, but to Mitt Romney and Newt Gingrich in particular?
Oh, it's huge, but I think of Florida as like four or five different states that happen to be part of one state. So you've got a lot of geography, you've got a lot of different economics, a lot of different differences in demographics, and it takes a lot of money in a very short period of time to get your message and your visibility out there. The money works in Romney's favor. Romney had a decent night last night. He went on the attack. It was something he's not that comfortable with. He's sort of like President Obama in that regard. Neither one is that they're not go for the jugular type guys. But he also was back in the corner, as somebody said. He's back in a corner with a broken bottle in his hand, is he going to use it?
Right.
And he didn't use it well, but as well as he might have if he had more experience. He didn't seem to enjoy it, maybe a little, but he certainly did it. And he needed to, and Gingrich was trying to, you know, try a new persona of the front runner, the above the fray. Oh, I'm not going to bother myself with this misinformation. Go look at my website. But Gingrich thinks when something passes that it's over. He thinks that the stuff with his ex-wife is over. Oh, no, it's not. He says, I got a bunch of friends who know it was a lie. Well, where are those friends? Who are those friends? And who did she tell back when? That's one thing. The whole business with the Freddie Mac contract, of a 6 or 8 year contract, he put out 1 year. The scope of services is whatever we ask you for, and he put in a lot of money. We need more information.
Right.
What did he produce? What did people say he produced? He says he didn't lobby, and lobbying is a legal term. But what he did do almost certainly is gave advice on who to talk to and what to tell them.
And according to Mitt Romney, he was, quote-unquote, influence peddling.
Well, that's the whole point. I mean, Tom Daschle's got into trouble for this. Other former politicians have tried to skirt this line. Well, I wasn't technically lobbying, so I didn't have to register as a lobbyist. But they do everything a lobbyist does except go in and have a meeting or get somebody on the phone and ask them for something. But you strategize, you work on messages, you target different people. That's what lobbyists do with most of their time. And I think that we're not done with that issue by any stretch. That's a lot of money that he took in.
Al, I want to ask you a question. One of the issues that came up in South Carolina that was addressed last night by Mitt Romney and addressed wholeheartedly, he released his taxes. Is the tax issue going to be a continued burden on Mitt Romney, do you think? Or is the other question, is Mitt Romney too rich to be president?
Well, that's going to continue to be one of the charges that he's going to have to deal with, and that will probably go, assuming he gets the nomination, it'll probably go all the way to the general election. But what I want to know is, when is the Las Vegas input to Newt Gingrich? I mean, Romney's got a lot of people that have given him money. Newt is getting pretty close to, there's one guy who's putting millions of dollars directly into his campaign. When is that going to become an issue? Romney didn't bring it up last night.
Bob, is that an issue? Is that something that maybe the general electorate should see more of out of the Romney camp?
Well, I suspect that they will. I believe I saw a report that Sheldon...
Sheldon Adelson.
Yeah. Put a second $5 million into the super PAC. So he spent $10 million in the last 2 weeks or 3 weeks giving money to Newt. So, and this is a big time casino owner.
Right.
That's not the nicest business to be in.
Al, there's a certain tawdriness to it. I don't know, the man may be perfectly legal in every respect, but it is the gambling.
Well, I'm sure he's doing nothing that's illegal.
But it's the gambling capital of the United States. Gambling has a certain
undertone to it,
and so much money coming from. If the guy gave him the first $5 million. I think that shocks me, but it may not shock a lot of other people. When he gives a second $5 million, that really astonishes me.
Alan,
this is an interesting issue. I don't think we're going to hear much from Romney about it. Romney's got much more money in his super PAC. They both talk about the distance that they have from the super PAC, although Newt's been more aggressive, saying, what do you mean you can't influence what they do? You can tell them that cut this stuff out. But if Newt gets $10 million from one guy and maybe a few hundred thousand from others, and Romney gets a couple of million from a whole bunch of guys, it's not exactly the issue that Romney can call attention to, but somebody will, somebody does. We're all aware of it. We're reading about it in the press. The guy's come up with another five. It's going to float around out there, and probably a moderator is going to raise it. I don't think it'll be Romney who raises it.
I think Gingrich has done a much better job of effectively communicating to people that he feels their pain. And they may be willing to overlook the fact that he's just received two $5 million checks.
Maybe they will. But if I were his opponent, I would begin calling him the candidate from Las Vegas.
That's what Romney has to do.
You wouldn't want
it won't
Romney.
Be Romney.
Romney won't say that.
Romney won't do that, but
the
Santorum could.
Or Paul could.
But it won't be Romney.
But the two players we have not talked about, not in South Carolina and in Florida, I mean, Ron Paul and Rick Santorum. Is Rick Santorum done after Florida, do you think? Alan?
I don't know that he's done. He's operated on a shoestring the whole time. You know, he's one for three. That's what Romney and Gingrich both are. And he beat Gingrich in New Hampshire, finished ahead of him. It was close, but he was ahead of him. So I don't know that he's done just because he's operating on such a shoestring, and he's got some dough. So I think we may see him around for a while, even if he finishes a distant third or even fourth in Florida.
Bob.
Santorum, in one sense, has to make a judgment. Now, he's not really active in, he's going to be in both of the debates, but he is not doing any. He's not spending money on the air in Florida. He's not doing anything in Florida. Neither is Paul, because they haven't got money. But the fact of the matter is, Santorum has to make a judgment in this case. Now, we're talking about some things that he could say about Romney, or things he could say about Gingrich. And he knows Gingrich better than he knows Romney, obviously, and he's not very fond of it looks like. But the fact of the matter is, he has to make a decision. Maybe the biggest thing he can do, and maybe the biggest decision he has to make, is how am I going to leave the race? What am I going to say about my fellow candidates as I leave the race? That may be the most important thing he does in the race to that 10% of the folks who support him, you know, give them a guidance of where he would go.
Does Al...
Who are you talking about?
Santorum.
Santorum.
Yeah.
Al, does Romney or Gingrich win Florida?
I have no idea because I don't know Florida. I'll tell you this about last night's debate. I watched that all the way through, and I ended up liking Ron Paul better than
ironically, the numbers coming out of the debate last night, Ron Paul, according to certain viewer polls, won last night by a hearty 25 or 30% above everybody else.
He comes across as very straightforward, very honest, very consistent, unflappable, kind of like the grandfather you trust.
Or the crazy uncle you put in the Barker Lounger.
No, but he's moved out of the Barker Lounger.
I thought he seemed less crazy last night than I had been led to believe in the other debates, which I did not watch. His ideas are unrealistic. They will not work. But I'll tell you, when you can go to the American public with something that is straightforward and simple and seems to make common sense, you pick up a lot of votes. And
remember Ross Perot.
Right. Good point. Alan, round the table. Does Newt Gingrich or Mitt Romney win Florida?
I think Romney pulls it out in a squeaker, but I sure wouldn't bet any money on it.
Bob?
I think I'm the same place, Alan. It's going to be very close, and no matter which way it goes, both of them will continue on.
Ralph?
Very close, I think, Romney, but look at the Cuban-American vote, how that breaks
down. I'm going to go a little John McLaughlin here. It will be Mitt Romney by 8 points. I will put money on that. You guys can call me on it next week. Romney by 8 points in Florida. We've got a couple of minutes left. This is my favorite time of the show. This is Tell Me a Story, where we talk about any of the rumor, hearsay, or buzz going around the Beltway, outside the Beltway. And today I am going to start with Robert. Tell me a story.
the Republicans in the House have been getting conflicting information from some of their advisors, and it's causing a little bit of they're not clear. They know what they want to do, which is talk about jobs.
The direction's not there.
But they're not exactly quite sure how to go about it.
Wow.
They're still working on it, and I think it. I'm sure they'll come up with what the answer they want. But they've got conflicting, not conflicting, but advice that does not exactly match the two very very well regarded pollsters and interviewers who have come back to them with stuff they picked up from focus groups,
right,
that is not exactly in sync.
Right. Ralph, tell me a story, real quick.
Okay. Cuban-American voters are about 30% of the voting base in the Republican primary in Florida. They're going to decide the winner. Watch and see if either Gingrich or Romney tone down their rhetoric on immigration to court this voting bloc.
Interesting. Alan, tell me a story.
I hate the term establishment Republicans because I never know exactly who it means. But there are a lot of smart Republican thinkers. There are Republican elected officials in Washington and around the country. They are mortified about the possibility of a Newt Gingrich candidacy. They think it is such a high risk, such an explosive environment, that he could bring a lot of stuff down around him if he were the candidate. Most of them haven't spoken out yet. A few of the editorial writers are beginning to say, this guy, Gingrich, is a real problem. He is out of control. He puts everybody at risk. If Newt wins in Florida, I think you're going to see a lot of these folks from around the country be a lot more assertive and aggressive in talking about how this, more overtly and directly about how this could be a real problem, and they might even look for a third way if Gingrich wins in Florida.
Wow. Al, tell me a story.
I agree with that. I can remember when the term liberal wasn't a nasty word. You, Bob, and I are old enough to remember those periods. And you'd have a liberal versus a conservative, and then they'd fight that out. Liberalism became a bad word, so it became progressive.
Right.
I'm not a liberal, I'm a progressive.
But you look the same, Al.
And you guys are regressive.
Yeah, no kidding.
Then it moved, everything moved farther to the right. Now, it's a bad word to be a moderate.
Right.
Now, the country's moving so far right in the Republican primary that Romney is having to fight off the idea that he's a moderate, which he probably is. My God, when you get into the general election, and it's not just the Republicans, which have moved with the Tea Party and all the rest farther to the right, a Republican moderate may be much more electable in the general election than it can be in the race or the nominee.
You're right. I agree. Mitch Daniels is giving the Republican response to the State of the Union address tonight. This is a direct line against labor. Mitch Daniels has got a problem with big labor there in Indiana with the right to work vote. Watch him come out about right to work and creating jobs